We're in a race against the Nazis. And I know what it means. If the Nazis have a bomb.
They have a 12-month head start.
18.
How could you possibly know that?
We've got one hope. All America's industrial might and scientific innovation connected here. A secret laboratory. Keep everyone there until it's done.
Let's go recruit some scientists.
Build a town, build it fast. If we don't let scientists bring their families, we'll never get the best.
Why would we go to the middle of nowhere for who knows how long?
Why? Why? How about because this is the most important thing to ever happen in the history of the world?
You're the great improviser, but this, you can't do in your head.
Are we saying there's a chance that when we push that button, we destroy the world?
Chances are near zero.
Near zero.
What do you want from theory alone?
Zero would be nice.
This is a matter of life and death. But I can perform this miracle.
World War II would be over. Our boys would come home.
That's happening, isn't it?
The world will remember this day.
Our work here will ensure a peace mankind has never seen. Until somebody builds a bigger one.
Hello, and welcome to the Movie Rockcast. I'm your host, Rob Daniel. And as always, I am so thrilled to say that split in the atom with me this week is my co-host, Rob Wallace.
Think of a physics pun. Think of a physics pun.
Come on. They expect a certain fusion between us.
Fission chips?
I was going to say he's fishing for something, but he's not catching anything. But he set me up for that one. That's the thing. He doesn't just take it for himself. He sometimes sets up his teammate. He's all about the assists.
Yeah, exactly. We between us, we're just like the Manhattan Project.
What, in terms of it's all complete hubris that is going to bring about the end of the world at some
exactly,
point?
Exactly, yeah. We're making a massive bomb.
We are making a massive bomb week after week, sending it out into the world without a care for the damage that it wrought upon all who listen to it. Anyway, yeah, so thanks for listening to this one. What are we talking about today, Rob?
Barbie.
Yes. This, if all goes well, is going to be a Rush episode. So you'll have heard the Barbie one. Thanks for listening to that. If you haven't actually listened to it yet, then there's still time before the world ends. And yeah, so this is the...
There's a non-zero chance us releasing this episode of the podcast will set fire to the atmosphere.
Yeah, that's right. Well, maybe our insights into this film will crackle with such fusion and it'll be such a fission of ideas that, we will accidentally set light to the atmosphere. Actually, we'll get onto that in a bit because there was the question that I wanted to have answered and I could just Google it, but I was hoping the film would tell me, but it didn't, and it was about that. Anyway, but we'll get onto that in just a second. Yeah, so what are we talking about today, Rob?
Barbie.
Yeah, I was going to say, go on, you come up with that. I've already told you. This is the Heimer, or the Nheimer, to the Barbenheimer. So we're talking about Oppenheimer, obviously. So this is the new film from Christopher Nolan. As you would have heard on that previous episode, this is his first film made outside of Warner's in 18 years. So he's been with Warner's since Batman Begins in 2005. But he had a split with them because...
Hey.
Yep, indeed.
There we go.
I wasn't even trying for that one, but I'm just up and at them wherever I am.
You've already done the app. No, it's fine.
Yeah,
it's fine. It's fine. They're all good. They're all good.
So, yes, as you would have heard on the previous episode, when Warner's announced they would be releasing their films onto HBO Max, whatever it was called at that point, as well as in the theatre, or sometimes instead of the theatre, Christopher Nolan was so incensed.
Or sometimes not at all.
Well, sometimes not at all, yes, indeed. If they really, really wanted to write it off as a tax write-off and really embrace the art. But yes, but Christopher Nolan was so incensed by the turn that Warner's was taken in terms of how it was treating the filmmakers that he splits with them. And that was quite a big thing because he was kind of the modern Kubrick for them because, of course, Kubrick found a home at Warner Brothers. And this seemed to be the same thing that was happening with Nolan because Nolan's such a devotee of Kubrick. So yeah, it was like, oh my God, so he's not going to be at Warner's for the foreseeable future. And it really is the foreseeable future because Warner's right now, the guy in charge of it, just seems to be strip mining the place for parts. But anyway, so this has seen him go over to Universal. So to quickly talk about this one, this is about J. Robert Oppenheimer, who was the brilliant physicist, introduced quantum mechanics to the US.
And his struggle to discover what the J stands for.
Yes, that's right, yes. What does it stand for, though?
Sorry, but that was another Simpsons joke I was making. But
they can't all be Simpsons jokes.
They can. I think I'm proving they can all be Simpsons
yes,
jokes.
That's right.
Or they can be Simpsons references that are delivered in the form of jokes. Julius. It stood for Julius.
It stands for Julius, right. And of course, Oppenheimer is best known as the director of the Manhattan Project, which was the initiative towards the end of World War II. Well, actually, from about 1942, it seemed to be a 3-year-long project, which I wasn't aware of when I watched the film, to take the recently discovered technology of splitting the atom and apply that to a bomb, because it seemed to be that's what obviously the Nazis are going to try and do with this. They are going to create the ultimate weapon. And it's quite important that America gets there first because the Nazis with a nuclear bomb or with an atom bomb, well, that's going to make things much more difficult to win the war. There's also the element that Oppenheimer was Jewish. And that is a element of his character that is actually dealt with more than I thought it would be in this film. I mean, there's a lot going on in this movie. Albert Einstein is in this film as well, played by Tom Conti and another famous Jewish scientist.
What, one among quite a few in this film. There's a Barbie-like roster of famous intellectuals.
Yes, indeed, definitely. But anyway, yes, yeah, so over the course of 3 incident-packed hours, I thought, we see the early life of Oppenheimer. Most of the film focuses on the Manhattan Project, but we also see after the war and how he kind of fell from political favour and became the subject of scrutiny around Reds Under the Bed and the communist witch hunts of the 50s.
Are you telling me that Christopher Nolan has made a film set in multiple time periods? Or...
Well, that's the thing, is that it's...
It's done very elegantly, though, isn't it, I think?
Yeah, I mean, it flashes forwards and backwards between about, I think, 4 distinct time periods. And it does it really without any use of on-screen titles. I mean, you have... In that Dunkirk way, there's a title that comes up that says 1 fusion, 2 fission, and it basically demarcates the 2 main time periods in this film. But there are other
one of which is initially shot in black and white.
And pretty much is in black and white the whole film. And then there's another one that is in colour. And the one in colour is all around the Manhattan Project and his early life as well. Everything that seems to happen after the war is in black and white. And again, yeah, as you said, that's a very elegant way to structure this film. Yeah, I thought it worked pretty beautifully the way that it was told. So just to put my cards on the table about this. So in the last episode, you said that Barbie was in your top 5 of the year so far. This is a film of the year contender for me. I thought this was first class, which was a huge sigh of relief after Tenet. I mean, have you warmed to Tenet since you saw Tenet?
No.
No, me neither, really. And I mean, it's one of those, I love Nolan. So when I saw Tenet in an Amazon sale for £3.97 on 4K, I thought, well, obviously I need to buy that so I could have the complete set of Nolan films in 4K.
It brought you no joy.
It brought me no joy. I did watch it again, and it's like, it really does seem as if he was just revisiting and rehashing his greatest hits. But the thing about Tenet that actually seems to have added some value to it is that he seemed to realise that he really needed to change the record and has done Oppenheimer. Oppenheimer, stylistically and thematically, does have links to his previous work, but it is quite separate. I mean, this is the first film since, I think, Insomnia that hasn't got a big spectacular action sequence in it. Something that will send people out talking about how amazing that bit was.
Which is not to say there isn't some impressive spectacle.
Oh, I was exhilarated the whole way through. I mean, it was not just in terms of the... And I think it's been released so much now, but they were able to practically approximate a nuclear explosion. I don't think they actually set off a nuclear bomb. Although you never know with Nolan. But no, they kind of seem to practically realise a nuclear explosion. And that is a bit of spectacle. But it's terrifying, I thought. It'll be interesting to see what other people think about, because it was not presented as spectacle.
I saw it in IMAX.
Well, can we part that? Because I want you to tell me all about that. Because I saw this film on a mid-range screen at Tottenham Court Road Odeon. It wasn't the big screen. It wasn't where I saw Megan. It was on the second size screen. So it was a small screen. I was in the front row and I was exhilarated watching it. I was exhilarated because of the way that the film was being told, the way that it would flash backwards and forwards between the different time frames. I think it was just so intelligent in terms of how it was presenting these characters, and also expected you to bring a certain amount of intelligence to the film, not in terms of understanding the science. I think it's very clever in terms of how it gives you enough about the science that you kind of go along with it without having to understand how any of this works. It's kind of like when you watch a card game in a movie and it's like, I don't need to know how that card game is played. The filmmaker just needs to tell me that's important and I can, you know, kind of follow the emotional beats of this scene now. That's how I thought this film dealt with the science. But it was really the study of brilliance and how brilliance can be absolutely electrifying to be around, but it can also be a weapon in and of itself against the person who is brilliant as much as those around him. And there's other things going on in this film as well, but we can talk about that in a moment because, well, one, I want to hear what you thought of the film, because I don't know what you thought of it, and I'm really, really fascinated to hear what you think of it, and also that IMAX experience.
I thought it was brilliant.
Ah, brilliant.
I was won over by it very quickly. It's a character study.
Yeah.
But it is based on the book The Modern Prometheus, which is, again, a biography of Oppenheimer.
Is it American Prometheus?
American Prometheus, that's it. Yeah. Sorry, Modern Prometheus is something else. Modern Prometheus is Frankenstein.
Which this actually bears some resemblance to in someone who creates something that's never been seen before, this brilliant scientist who creates something that's never been seen before and might have brought about, well, and did bring about complete destruction because of it and then had to wrestle with the guilt of that. Yeah, I mean, he is a literal modern-day Frankenstein, but yeah, sorry, go on.
So it opens with him at university. There are some effects there that was like, oh, this is vaguely reminding me, although I think it's much better executed, me of A Beautiful Mind in terms of like the phenomena that he's seeing, and it really like it immerses you for a film that's, you know, kind of a historical epic almost. It really does immerse you in the mindset of this character and makes you understand the fact that, you know, he is treated, the film refers to him a couple of times as a prophet. He didn't create the field of quantum physics, but he made it a practical science. That kind of led the movement that made it a practical science.
Well, he took it to America.
Yeah.
And I think because of America and its resources and things like that, and also its Ivy League universities, it was something that enabled it to flourish.
It does kind of talk about the fact that he was Jewish. I found it fascinating the fact that it mentions that one of the things that might have, that I'm not saying it wasn't necessarily decisive, but would have prevented or delayed the development of the atom bomb in the in Nazi Germany was the fact it was perceived as being a Jewish science.
Yeah, the quantum mechanics was seen as a Jewish science. So anti-Semitism is something that actually slowed them down in working out how to create the super weapon. But yeah, it is one of those things where it's like the insanity of the Nazis actually meant that they weren't able to create this weapon because of their hatred. And that adds another incredibly complex layer to this as well, because of course the Americans built a weapon and used it against Japanese civilians in what could be seen as a supreme act of complete destruction.
The Nazis aren't the only ones who are kind of held back by kind of ideological hatred in this, because obviously the spectre of communism plays in terms of a lot of the scientists being left-leaning, and how certainly after the war that became much more of an issue with the rise of McCarthyism. And I mean, I know there have been complaints, the fact that the actual bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, they're referenced and they do play a significant role. They have a devastating impact on Oppenheimer, as played by Cillian Murphy.
Mm-hmm.
But there's been some kind of criticism around the fact that they take place off screen, essentially how we only ever really see it through the lens of Oppenheimer. And it's like, yeah, but that's the film that's being made. That's the viewpoint. And there is the oh, he's president. Is it FDR? It's FDR as played by James Remar.
He wasn't the president. He was.
Oh, no, he wasn't. Yeah, because that wasn't FDR. He was.
He was a senator. It's Truman appears as a president in this.
As played by, yeah, we would.
No,
don't reference
because Empire referenced that, and I thought, well, actually, that is a spoiler because it happens so late in the film, and it's such a good cameo that
That was the one. I think it's a good performance in that role. I found it a bit distracting.
I thought that was great. We will, I think, have a small spoiler section on this one. Talk about a few elements of the film.
Although there's a slight irony that we're taking the spoiler section to talk about the historical film.
Yeah, indeed, but there's some of the choices made.
But the fact that the governor, sorry, the senator character, and is it spoiler to say there are other targets and the reasons why some were chosen and some were not are not always as purely, you'd hope that decisions were made, if horrible decisions are made, you'd hope they'd be being made for ethical or at least military reasons. It's not always the case.
Actually, I would slightly disagree with that. It was the case, but there's like an addendum to it that got a very wry laugh in the audience I saw it with. But they purposely chose not to bomb certain areas because of the spiritual and cultural value to the people, which actually is something that America seems to have forgotten now, that then that's how you win the peace. That point about the bombing of Hiroshima and Nagasaki, it's like, well, no, I think that would have been completely out of place in this film because, well, we can't really talk about that until we get into spoilers, other than to say it's very easy to make that look like spectacle. And when you see destruction on a massive scale, it's very easy to stray into Terminator 2 territory. Well, that's a sobering moment in T2, but it's also a big set piece moment, and this is not the film that's being told here, and it's actually omitted for a very good reason, I thought, and we'll get onto that in spoilers.
So the ensemble cast in this is fantastic.
It kind of reminded me of the old prestige films, because this does have a prestige feel to it. It reminded me of the old prestige films from the 60s, like The Longest Day or something like that, where everyone is in it. Who is in this film?
To do it in roughly the order from Wikipedia, Cillian Murphy as Oppenheimer, Emily Blunt as Kitty Oppenheimer, his wife, Matt Damon as the General Leslie Groves, Robert Downey Jr. as Louis Strauss, who was their man on the hill.
Yeah, so Louis Strauss was the head of the Atomic Energy Commission.
Yeah, I think.
And is kind of a benefactor to Oppenheimer. They have an interesting relationship, yeah.
And Florence Pugh as Jean Tatlock, who was, somebody with whom Oppenheimer had previously had a relationship. And lots of recognisable actors playing influential scientists.
Yeah.
Including Josh Hartnett as Ernest Lawrence, Rami Malek as David L. Hill, and Kenneth Branagh, believe it or not, as Niels Bohr, Benny Safdie as Edward Teller. Benny Safdie, who was actually really recently very good in Are You There, God? It's Me, Margaret.
And is one half of the directing duo behind Uncut Gems and other Ace films.
Tom Conti as Albert Einstein. David Krumholtz as Isidore Isaac-Rabi.
Jack
Quaid as Richard Feynman.
Yeah.
It goes on.
Matthew Modine is in there.
Matthew Modine. Matthias Schweighofer as Werner Heisenberg, who he'd probably be recognisable from the those zombie films that, I forget the name of it, it's like Army of the Dead. Zack Snyder did that on Netflix. He's the German guy from that.
Yeah.
Or the Austrian guy from that.
But Heisenberg, of course, because there was a...
Who was Heisenberg?
There was a ripple of humour. Heisenberg, who Walter White names himself after in Breaking Bad. Oh, wow, that's Heisenberg.
Yeah, I hope that when I asked you, when I said who was Heisenberg, that was going to get a laugh, because...
Because he's the man who knocks.
Because it's the Heisenberg uncertainty principle.
Yeah, you are assuming way too much knowledge there, Rob.
It's basically, in very simple terms, it's that you can't know simultaneously know the location and speed of an... I think it's referring to an electron. And there's a joke about a cop who pulls over Heisenberg and says, "Do you know how fast you're going?" "No, but I know where I am."
That's funny, yeah. So who else was in the film?
James Remar, as we've said. Macon Blair.
Yes, Macon Blair was great.
As a lawyer.
As Jason Clarke as well. There's Olivia Thirlby, and she plays a female member of the Manhattan Project scientific team.
Lily Hornig.
who is first, well, is kind of assumed that she wants to be a secretary there, and then she kind of said, well, they didn't teach typing when I was studying for my physics PhD or something like that. Olivia Thelby was like, I was watching it thinking, who is she? And then at the end, it was like, oh my God, it's Judge Anderson from Dredd. She always should have had a bigger career than she did. She's also very good in a film, was it The Damascus Project or something like that? Anyway, she was very good. It was good to see her. I mean, she has a very small role in the film. She's, as does Jack Quaid. Jack Quaid is barely in this movie. It would be interesting to see if there was a 5-hour cut of this or something.
David Dasmachin, who's going to be in The Last Voyage of the Demeter, that's out next month, which is the Dracula film. There's Dane DeHaan.
There is.
Tony Goldwyn. Alden Ehrenreich.
Yeah, he's in it as well. It is an amazing cast. What was it like seeing it in IMAX?
Impactful, to say. Because, yeah, the explosion when it, you know, the nuclear blast, when it does happen, is not so overwhelming. They're not trying to, like, throw you back in your seat. But just the sheer scope of it. Things like this, the delayed blast wave. There's just something to be said from the sheer scale of the IMAX screen. I mean, the sound is great, but the sheer scale of it. Cillian Murphy's head's already the height of a double-decker bus. So seeing, you know, something that's, you know, that's meant to impress upon you. The film, although we won't spoil it here, is interesting in how it introduces the famous or infamous line that Oppenheimer said, you know, I am become death, destroyer of worlds.
Yeah. The thing about this film is that it's not a spectacle. It's men in rooms talking.
Yeah.
But the way that you can say that JFK is men in rooms talking, there is a kineticism to the editing and a propulsion to the pace of this movie that makes that pretty exhilarating. Was the whole thing shot in IMAX?
Yes.
Yeah. So I was thinking, well, there's no reason why this wouldn't be shot in IMAX because it's pretty much all indoors.
Yeah, nothing. Yeah.
That's interesting because you're basically watching a drama in massive IMAX. How did that work?
I'm 90% sure it was all shot in IMAX. Let me double check that just to make sure that I'm not misremembering, although, you know, I did see it yesterday, so I should remember this.
Yes, you should. At the end, the film says shot with IMAX film cameras, but of course I watched it on a regular screen. And it does seem to shoot safe for 2.35 because I watched it in widescreen and didn't ever think...
Yeah, it was shot entirely on IMAX 65mm. Oh, and Panavision 65mm, so yeah, it's not...
Okay, which must mean that they shot it kind of safe.
Yeah,
I mean, in IMAX. It would be interesting to see how it looks in IMAX. I do want to go and see it in IMAX.
I would go and see it again.
Yeah.
In IMAX.
Okay, right, yeah.
Although, yes, I now feel like seeing it not in IMAX would be like, no, it's a bit comparatively underwhelming.
And I watched it, as we said, on a very, very standard cinema screen. Not projected on film, it was projected digitally. Not that I thought that was a problem, to be honest. I loved it. Pretty much from the very beginning, it was like, okay, this is very, very intelligent filmmaking.
Because there are also so many personalities, it shows his and Tyr's kind of interpersonal relationships with so many different characters, all of whom are quite clearly delineated.
Yeah, indeed. And there's also a very, very good thing that the film does. If it mentions someone that you haven't seen for a while, it will do a very, very quick flashback to that person to kind of remind you who they are. It's also very clever. I mean, there is a thing about let's get all the faces in there because that makes it a prestige film. It also means that people will come and see it. It's also very handy when you have a film that has dozens of speaking parts to have very, very famous people play those parts so you can remember who's who.
On a side note, last week I was up in Bar Elba at Waterloo with a friend of mine. I saw somebody wearing a hat and sunglasses who I thought, absentmindedly, that looks a lot like Rami Malek. There's probably a pretty good chance that was Rami Malek.
Yes, who's also in this film.
Who's also in this film.
Yeah. So what were the other elements of film that you enjoyed?
Again, the fact that it does manage to convey the science behind it in not simple terms, the film doesn't patronise you, but in clear dramatic terms that help you to understand the complex scientific principles, but in a way that works dramatically. For example, there are two bowls sit on Oppenheimer's desk, you know, on this table, and the marbles going into one represents plutonium that's funding one project, and marbles going to the other represent a uranium that's being used for another project. I knew a little bit about the science, but the fact that the film manages to convey this without ever feeling like it's being patronising or simplistic, but also while never assuming knowledge.
Yeah.
Previously in a lot of films, you know, like Inception and certainly Tenet, you kind of get exposition dumps because the film requires them in order to function. I'd argue in Tenet we could have maybe done with a bit more exposition, or at least, a bit, you know, handled differently. Yeah. Whereas this film has to kind of convey it organically, because you've got characters talking to each other who already know this stuff. Or they're exchanging ideas, exchanging theories.
Yeah, indeed, definitely. It's it's a really good point. You never get the impression in this film that it's like, well, you wouldn't say that because they already know that. The way that, for example, in Interstellar, when Matthew Mahomene says, well, a wormhole is basically, and gets the piece of paper, folds it in half and punches it through with a pen and says, well, we go through this because we bend space, you see. And it's like, you are literally talking to an astronaut on an interstellar spaceship. I think he might know that already. That's a bit artless. But okay, fine, fine. I mean, I actually think that Interstellar is massively underrated and I love it. But it's but that is one of those scenes where it's like, it must have been that way to do that. This film doesn't have that in it. I never got the impression it's like, well, you would never tell him that as if you didn't know it.
This film, in terms of it, I guess, maybe I'm reading it stylistically, or maybe it's just in terms of the setting or the period detail, reminds me a little bit of The Master.
Yeah, I mean, in the look of it, it's Hoyt Van Hoyt Temma, who seems to be Nolan's cinematographer now. I think his first film was on Dunkirk. I think he worked with Wally Pfister up until that point.
And Dunkirk has some of my favourite cinematography in any film.
Yeah, indeed. I mean, it's just an absolute miracle of a visual movie, that is. Not so much technic, but anyway, it's fine. But yeah, that's the thing, is that it does have that feel of The Master, that kind of mid-20th century point when a lot of discoveries were being made, and it seemed almost as if it was back in the 19th century again or something, when they were, you know, discovering the Industrial Revolution and steam power and stuff like that. This seems to be like the next scientific leap against the urgency of the greatest conflagration of all time in terms of World War II. And that's what came through really well, I thought, in terms of everyone is talking as if they are living this history now. This seems like a very modern film in terms of what's happening in Europe is influencing everything that's happening here, as well as all the scientific discoveries that are being made. That, just in terms of immersive history, I thought that the film scored a bullseye with that.
This film is 3 hours and does not feel like it.
It doesn't feel like 3 hours, does it? I mean, that's the thing, is that we've talked, well, you have accommodated me just banging on recently about how films are too long. This kind of proves a film can be any length as long as it justifies the length. And this really did not feel like 3 hours.
I think because...
But we'll get into...
I think partly because it's packed with those interpersonal relationships.
Oh, it is. That's the thing, is that one of the things that works about this film is that, yes, the main thrust of the film is a brilliant mind gathers many other brilliant minds around him, has, as we said, all the resources in the world at that point. $2 billion of 1940s money. They built their own town to create the atom bomb. And, of course, one of the main elements of this is how does that affect the person, even someone as supercilious as Oppenheimer, how does that affect them, particularly when they realise what they've done and what the world is now going to do with it. And that's something that is given space to play out, and it plays out very, very subtly. And the way that the Cillian Murphy plays, I mean, I kind of think, yeah, if it was up to me, it'd be like, well, I can't imagine there being a better male performance in a film this year come Oscar time for a film that's going to be nominated for Oscars. This, I think, would be his...
I'm sorry, have we not already talked about Barbie?
Well, yeah, but he's going to be Best Supporting Actor, I think, because he would definitely get that. So Ryan Gosling would definitely get Best Supporting Actor. But Cillian Murphy, so I just think this film might be not positive enough for the Academy to give him that Oscar. I hope I'm wrong.
Or I think he's also surrounded by, not that it attracts him anything, it elevates his, so many good performances. The film's called Oppenheimer, his is, but other characters are so well characterised that, you know, I wouldn't be surprised, for example, if Robert Downey Jr. had an Oscar, had a supporting actor nom.
Yeah, I think he and Matt Damon are probably front and centre to get the best foreign actor noms from that film. But I think here it's like the way that Oppenheimer was the director of the Manhattan Project, and to go to Steve Jobs, the Danny Boyle film with Michael Fassbender, when someone says to Jobs, what do you do? He says, I conduct the orchestra. And that's what Oppenheimer's doing here. He is conducting the orchestra. But that's also what Cillian Murphy's doing on screen, I think. It's like, he is conducting this film, obviously, but Nolan is behind the scenes as the ultimate conductor. He's the director and also the writer, and actually the producer, one of the producers. But Cillian Murphy is on screen, and you never lose focus that this is his story and that he is the director. He is the one that is overseeing all of the different departments that are doing this stuff. So he is conducting the orchestra. And the way that that zeal and passion and ambition then turns into something more regretful over the course of the film in a character who can sometimes be quite opaque and guarded and sometimes it's a recurring motif in the film that people say, well, what do you think about this? What do you think? What is your opinion of this? And he's quite guarded in what he says. But the way that you see the shift pretty much in terms of how he acts through facial expressions and body language, it's like, well, I just think this is the best acting, right? I mean, I have no doubt this is a living, breathing person in front of me. And that is the same for all the other characters, as you said, but that central performance I thought was absolutely extraordinary.
Yeah, I'd say it's definitely my top five of the year.
Yeah. So Nolan, I think, is always seen as quite, is often lazily dismissed as a very cold director, which I don't think is true at all. I think there's a lot of emotion in his films. And this does seem to be a cry from the heart in terms of this is a very, very dangerous thing that we've got. And we seem to be forgetting just how dangerous it is. And with war in Ukraine and Putin being obviously at least a little bit deranged with lots of nuclear weapons, there's a chance that, as the end of Dr. Strangelove says, we'll meet again. And that's something that I thought, this seems very, very personal to him, including the fact that there's a image in the film of an impassive-looking woman with the skin being blasted off her face by a nuclear blast that's played by Nolan's daughter. Okay, you're clearly putting some of yourself into this movie, I thought.
I'd agree, and having recently come back from Japan and having visited Hiroshima, to review a dramatization of some of the discussions and the principles and the science that absolutely devastated, and as they say in the end, directly or indirectly, was 200,000 people.
And I did like that element of the film when it was talking about the drive to not use the weapon as a weapon, to use it only as a
deterrent or to...
Or as like a demonstration. It's like, because there was a real drive from very, very prominent, influential people to get key members of the Japanese military and government and the German military and government over to America and basically do a test and just like, yeah, build a village and saying, look, yeah, this is what we've created and we will drop it if we have to. But it was decided no, because it is one of those things where it's like America, I think, yeah, realised this is also a bit of a warning to Russia as well. Like, yeah, to the Soviet Union that we have the bomb and we have more than one. It's a sobering film, but it is absolutely brilliant. What do you think about the female characters in the movie?
I think often marginal without being marginalised.
Mm.
In terms of, Emily Blunt as Kitty and the complexity of her and Oppenheimer's relationship. And I can imagine, as the film suggests, he was not a particularly easy man to live with.
Yeah.
But while doing it without ever being reductive or patronising, actually, as Oppenheimer at one point says in the film, we are adults. We understand each other. And then Florence Pugh as Jean Tatlock. The film was never reductive in the treatment of any of its characters. Even people who, and these were, I think those are probably the two most substantial female roles. But even in characters who are on screen only for a couple of minutes, you get an impression of fully rounded human beings who aren't just being conveniently used as narrative props.
Yeah.
Right. And also, I read that at least some of the dialogue during the various commissions, largely after the war, at least some of the people's testimony in those, if not, I guess, potentially all of it, is taken from the transcript.
Yeah, I was wondering that, because it had the feel of that.
Which part of me admires, just on the basis of, like, the context may be different. Obviously, you've changed. A lot of this is fictionalized. But if you're able to keep that in and have that work dramatically in your film and make sense, it's like, oh, wow, no, you're doing something right.
Yeah, it's an interesting one because it's a very, very male-focused film because it's looking at a male-focused world in a male-focused time. And agree with the...
There's a shout-out to Barbie. There are even horses.
That's right. Actually, that was one thing about horses. That's what mentioned on the Barbie. There's a very, very good running joke about horses in Barbie that made me laugh, including about the patriarchy in horses. Yeah, I'd agree with what you say about the female characters are not marginalised. I mean, it's a difficult one in terms of they are there basically to show elements of the Oppenheimer character and also to kind of soften him and humanise him in some ways and to show that he is... Well, that he did have physical relationships, that he did have loving relationships, and he had a family, and that he did have a certain fragility to him. I still thought that the characters were well sketched enough and also very well played, particularly Emily Blunt, who does a lot of acting with her eyes, particularly during the hearings and things like that. And she has a key moment during one of them as well, which is fantastic. And it'd be interesting to see how much of that was from a transcript and how much of that was embellished for the movie. And actually, that was one scene that I thought, this would be interesting to watch in IMAX, because even though it's just people in a room talking, this is a set piece moment in this film, and the entire audience is galvanized by this. So how was that in IMAX?
Yeah, cool.
I'm trying to think if there's anything else about it before we quickly do a spoiler section. The fact that the kids were always crying, I thought, was very, very symbolic as well of, like, there always seems to be a wail of despair from his kids because, of, you know, they're the future. He is creating something that is going to jeopardize everyone's future, and it seemed to be just this cry that they realised what was going on. And that was, like, a nice little subtle touch, I thought. But, yeah, anything else before we get into spoilers?
The fact that, you know, neither of them have portrayed Kitty or Oppenheimer or Robert are portrayed as being very good parents.
Yeah.
And the film is, like, largely not judgmental of them for that.
Again, it's like, it's a very adult film in terms of the way that it depicts people as saying, yeah, these are not perfect, and in some ways these people are deeply flawed, and his wife has alcohol dependency issues and he is emotionally unavailable some of the time. And there's that scene when he goes to see his friend and basically talk about that and says how ashamed he is. And again, that was just a really, really nice moment. Yeah, there's so much going on in this film. And I'm actually going to think, it sounds like giving away lots of spoilers. We're not. There's so much more in this film. I mean, it's like literally touch the surface. I mean, we haven't really talked about the editing style and the inserts in this that really do place the film on a much more cosmic scale in terms of what's being harnessed here. It does suggest the power of the universe is being harnessed here. And these people on this tiny planet have managed to work out how to do this. And it's the most dangerous thing that could possibly happen. That comes across really strongly because of the way that it's edited. I think this is a step up for Nolan in terms of he has emerged from action cinema. Yeah, he's one of my favourite directors, but he is a director who has always had action scenes in his films. Even Memento has action scenes in it. There are chase scenes and there are things like that, and Insomnia has the same, and yeah, Following, I think, might even...
Yeah, Following. Memento has one of my favourite chase scenes in all cinema.
Yeah, indeed, yeah. So what am I doing? I'm chasing this guy. Nope, he's chasing me. if you haven't seen Memento, you gotta just watch it. I watched it again a few years ago when I was reading that book, The Nolan Variations by Tom Schoen, which if you haven't read that, then go out and buy The Nolan Variations.
I've got a copy of that on the shelf somewhere.
You have. It is a fantastic book. It was great because I could watch the films as I was reading the book. It's only made like a few films, or like, yeah, 10 or 11 movies. Or maybe 12 now, anyway. And it was great to watch them as I was reading about them. A Memento I hadn't seen in years, and my God, that film holds up so well. It actually looks better now, I think, than when it came out.
And when it came out, the conceit of it was so ingenious, but the fact that it's managed to hold on to that without it becoming, like, feeling passé or...
Well, it kind of created a subgenre of that, didn't it? The things being told backwards, which of course have been done in literature before, but... Here it was like, it suddenly popped up in episodes of Firefly and things like that. And it was like, oh, okay. And Irreversible is a film that is heavily indebted to Memento.
It's use of nonlinear, yeah.
I mean, Insomnia is a real outlier in terms of it is a film told chronologically. Although I actually spoke of Batman as well, and all the other films. Yeah, his films outside of the superhero films and Insomnia are the ones where he kind of mucks about with time. Well, yeah, I mean, I would just strongly recommend you go and see this. I think it's very accessible. But it's an adult movie, and I think that it expects you to go with your brain engaged. And to be completely honest, and I'll talk more about the audience and spoilers, but overall, the audience that I saw this with, and it was a sellout Saturday lunchtime audience, and it went down very well. I mean, at the end of the film, I watched all the credits and then stood up and looked around, and there were still people sitting there. And it didn't seem as if they were expecting a post-credit scene either. No, he's not going to come back and say he's going to set up an Atom Initiative, but no, they seemed to just want to watch the film and to the end and have a think about it. And there were quite a few of them that did that. It wasn't just like, you know, normally it's just me and one other guy with glasses, but there were quite a few people in the audience who... stay to the very end. So, well, that's good. So, yeah, it came as a very nice surprise to find out that it had done $80.5 million in the US in its opening weekend and about another 97 around the world. Yeah, it's going to make quite a bit of money, which is astonishing for the sort of film it is. But yes, if anything else before spoilers.
I think that's me.
All right, okay then. Well, you'll hear a bit of the trailer and then you'll be in the spoiler zone. But shall we do the plugs and stuff before that?
Yes, shall we?
Okay, cool. So, Mr. W., if people want to find you on the internet, where can they do that?
Yeah, sure. If you're looking for me online, you can find me on Twitter at Robert M. Wallace. You can also find my writing, such as it is, at Of All The Film Sites, www.ofallthefilmsites.com. If you've enjoyed this podcast and looking for something maybe a little different, Mr. D and I have done a scene-by-scene breakdown, analysis, general... just love letter, yeah, to the 1986 cult classic Highlander. It's a podcast called Another Time McLeod. We've had some amazing guests on it. You can listen to that wherever you're listening to this. You can also follow that on Twitter at McLeod Time. And if you're so inclined, drop us a Highlander themed email at whowantstopodforever@gmail.com.
Thank you very much. And yeah, if you want to follow me on Twitter, I'm at rob_a_daniel. My writing is at electric-shadows.com. You can find me on Letterboxd at letterboxd.com/robdan. More importantly, if you want to go looking for the podcast online, then you can find it on Twitter at MovieRobcast, on Instagram at TheMovieRobcast. And yeah, if you've liked what you've heard, then why not leave us a star rating and or review wherever you listen to your podcasts. It always helps us with the algorithms and whatnot, and it's always very much appreciated. So thank you very much for that. So we are going to talk about some spoilers for Oppenheimer, maybe minor in some ways, but I would strongly suggest that you just go and watch the film first, because there are some things in here that I wouldn't want to have spoiled myself. So yeah, cheers for listening, and we will play a bit of the trailer and then you'll be in spoilers.
Truman needs to know what's next.
Two.
What's next?
One.
Cool, you are now in the spoiler section. The end of this film, so the bomb is detonated, I would guess, at around maybe just over the 2 hour mark.
Yeah.
And there's about another hour of the film, which goes into the communist witch hunt and the hearing that was basically set up to disgrace him, that we find out was orchestrated by the Strawes character, played by Robert Downey Jr., who was still seething over being humiliated by him at a previous hearing. That's also the sequence when you really begin to get a sense of just how distraught Oppenheimer is of what he's done. And that extraordinary sequence when he's giving that speech and kind of saying what he thinks they want to hear about, yeah, the Germans.
As the whole room is like shaking around him.
Yes, indeed.
It's all like something out of a horror film.
Yeah, indeed. It's like, he basically, yeah, you know this because we're in spoilers now, but he addresses all the people that worked on the Manhattan Project and says all the jingoistic stuff about like, yeah, well, I'm sure that the Japanese didn't like it and I only wish we could have talked to the Germans in this way as well. Ha ha. And they're stamping their feet. And that, you realise, was a flash forward earlier on in the film when you saw the feet stamping and just that march, and it goes from something quite triumphant to just this march towards destruction, because after that the arms race starts, the world becomes a much more dangerous place, and that inexorable march towards, well, the hydrogen bomb as well, because there's that whole subplot about we need the hydrogen bomb, which is much more destructive than the atom bomb. All of that stuff I thought was absolutely brilliant. And that's the scene where I think you first see the recurring image of the girl with the skin being flayed off her face. So all of that stuff after the bomb, when it goes into all the politics of it and the real destruction of his character for a while, and then he was rehabilitated, and you get that really, really nice scene with Einstein when he talks about what happened to me will happen to you.
But yeah, you were worried that by doing this that we'd ignite the atmosphere and destroy the world. I think we might have destroyed the world anyway.
Yeah, when I said I was worried that I would destroy the world, I think I actually did that. It was an amazing way to end the film. So the film ends. I'm sitting there just basking in the glow of its brilliance. To my right, three people, again, everyone just seems to be in their early 20s around me right now whenever I go to the cinema. I would say they were mid to late 20s, probably, something like that. It was two guys and this woman. And the woman turns to the blokes and says, okay, after they blew up the bomb, what was happening in that film? What was the last hour of that film? Can someone explain this plot of what was happening in the last hour of that movie? I mean, what was the story? And it's like, okay, so I think you might have lost the thread of who was who and what was happening there. And if you lost the thread of that, then
it's going to be very hard to get it back.
Yeah, indeed. It's like, and I'm kind of surprised that you did, but maybe, but okay, cool. I mean, she just seemed, said like, can you explain to me what was happening? And one of them said, Yeah, I think when it was black and white, that was things that were happening kind of later after the war. And she said, yeah, well, I don't know why you're talking. Every time I looked at you, you were asleep. So I was just sitting there, kind of listening to this with a smile on my face, just listening to these people that had had such a different experience to me. And it has to be said, I think, to most of the other people in there, because it was a responsive audience. They did laugh at the right moments, because there is some leavening humour here. And there's a nice gag about the amount of babies that have been born in that town because everyone just seems to be shagging everyone. And but yeah, that was interesting just to hear someone who had lost the thread of who was who, because there are multiple speaking parts in this movie. But it did make me laugh. Yeah, I don't know why you're talking. Every time I looked at you, you were asleep.
Shooting my eyes from the blast.
Maybe, yeah, indeed. That's right. I forgot my welder's goggles. That was maybe like a counterbalance to what we thought of it. But anyway, I thought it was quite well done in terms of how it managed to keep you aware of who's who. You haven't even really mentioned that Kenneth Branagh was in this movie.
Yeah, as Niels Bohr.
As Niels Bohr, yeah. As Danish, was he a Danish physicist?
I think so.
And was basically Oppenheimer's mentor. And Branagh seems to be the new Michael Caine. Now that Michael Caine maybe is just too old for movies. Or that, I think he's got another film coming out with... Is it Glenda Jackson in it or someone like... No, because she's been dead a while now. But anyway...
No, she's been dead for a while. She's only been dead a couple of weeks.
Then I think it is Glenda Jackson. So he's got another film coming out, but he's not in this film. And he's not even in it as like a voice like he was in Dunkirk. So I think that Kenneth Branagh, who appeared in Dunkirk and Tenet, and now this one, I think could be the new Michael Caine lucky charm for Christopher Nolan films. And they didn't say how long it would take for the world to be engulfed in fire if the atmosphere
did ignite.
I want to know that. I wonder how long would it take for the Earth to catch fire if it was one spark in New Mexico that then ignited the world? How long that would take? Anyway, I was hoping the film would tell me, but it didn't. But yes, other things in terms of spoilers. I mean, yeah, the big twist, the big revelation is that it was the Robert Downey Jr. character that was behind the character assassination.
Were you surprised by that?
Not really. It was one of those.
Because it was one of those that, as soon as it introduces the dossier that David S. Mason character has been given, at that point you're like, well, it's going to be someone close to him because that's the only way that this works dramatically.
Yeah.
And you're like, oh, it's probably going to be Strauss because he's somebody who would conceivably have access to that, and I can. He's a more politician, and
it's one of those things as well where the film's kind of starts off with him saying to Oppenheimer, I'm a big fan, basically. Like, yeah, I'm a great admirer of your work. And Oppenheimer's quite kind of haughty with him. Not just in like that way that he tends to act with people. That really nice line when the Strauss character says, yeah, I started off selling shoes. There was more money in selling shoes. So that's right. So you were a lowly shoe salesman. Just a shoe salesman.
The fact that, you know, he's called Strauss, but that's only because he's all spelled the same, but he changed pronunciation of Strauss. I mean, I could be wrong with that, but I think he was also of Jewish background.
Well, that adds another element to it as well, then. Because the David Krumholtz character is the Jewish confidant.
Almost like an older brother.
Yeah, indeed.
And the fact that, you know, he taught himself to speak German in order to lecture in quantum physics, and yet he doesn't speak any Yiddish.
That's right.
I like the
fact... Is it Dutch that he taught him?
Actually, it's Dutch. It's Dutch rather than German. I do like when he's got the copy of the Bhagavad Gita on the shelf.
Yes,
Written in Sanskrit, and Florence Pugh goes, you can read this, yeah, I've been teaching myself, and she showed him the page, and that's with nudity immediately following presumably a sex scene. That's when that line is first spoken, now I become Death, Destroyer of Worlds. This was not the context I was expecting this to arise in, so to speak.
No, indeed, that's right, and apparently that has ruffled some feathers amongst some religious communities, and it's like, yeah, okay, but
not yes. The fact that he apparently spoke that after detonating an act like that.
Yeah, indeed. It's like, I mean, it's like after releasing something that killed hundreds of thousands of people. Yeah, Jesus, what a world. Yeah, I was surprised that was the context in which that was said. And it's very intimate. There's a thematic thing there in terms of you've done the most intimate act, and then you say this thing, the line for which you are most famous, and the thing you are most famous for doing is creating the ultimate destructive act. And it's like, there's things going on in that scene that beyond the fact that Florence Pugh is topless. So maybe you could look at it on a more adult level.
She's going to be having an interesting year as well, given that she's also in Dune Part 2.
Yeah, yeah, indeed. What did you think of the scene when they're having sex at the hearing, when his wife suddenly is seeing them having sex during the hearing?
I thought it was interesting because, yeah, it's the fact that that's been kind of exposed and this detail of their personal lives, you know, how incredibly vulnerable you'd feel in that moment.
Yeah.
Almost like, well, in that case, literally, but figuratively watching that play out in front of her.
Yeah. I thought it worked better as an idea than it did dramatized. It was one of those moments where I thought the film took a slight misstep. The idea of this is very interesting. The way it's happening is, I think, because it goes on for quite a long time. And it's like, I just think this has kind of made its point and maybe now is kind of moving into a slightly, not silly, but over-egged
realm. Although I guess it's, in that scene, it's interesting because all the visions, it's almost entirely from his POV.
Yeah.
Apart from that scene, which especially in that hallucination or that vision is quite literally explicitly from her POV.
Yeah, indeed, yeah.
And it's maybe saying, here's a contrasting view of the world. She's also carrying trauma.
Mm.
And maybe, yeah, is that the only time where you could argue that the film, like, explicitly, not just has different characters in it, but, like, explicitly breaks from his POV to say very clearly, here is somebody else's vision of the world?
I think it is, yeah.
Although, you know, obviously it does that to a degree with the Strauss character in the sequences where he's in front of the commission going for that role in the cabinet.
Yeah.
Well, that's right, the committee, what's it called?
The cabinet.
The cabinet. I like how the film does express the nice irony of, oh no, this isn't a trial. There's no burden of proof.
Is there a point where you see things from Straw's perspective that
I think
the vision or?
No, I just mean in terms of, I think particularly the moment where he clocks the fact that, you know, that he's been caught out in this irony. And actually the fact that he does get that speech about he wanted us to martyr him so that because he felt that meant he could be forgiven.
Mm-hmm.
You all just saw him as this man of science who was naive to politics, but he wasn't. He was manipulative.
But I do think it's one of those where he did allow himself to be flagellated because of guilt, I think is what the film is suggesting in terms of this hearing and him not really fighting back against it. But also I think it then kind of goes back to what Einstein says, where these things just happen in cycles. It happened to me, it'll happen to you. This just goes on. It's a repeating pattern.
Well, the line I said specifically that came from a transcript was what Teller says, the Benny Safdie character, says about, I think he's a patriot, I think, but I don't understand him, therefore I can't fully trust him. And that's taken from the transcript.
A lot of that has been blamed on professional rivalry and jealousy from Edward Teller, who apparently was the inspiration...
Dr. Strangelove.
Yeah, indeed. Actually, the other thing is that Gary Oldman plays the president, and I thought that was very good casting, but I'll just a second.
Yeah.
James Remar was in the film as the senator. Does he play Henry Simmons, I think it is, or something like that? Because James Remar is, he's not a B-movie actor, but he's one of those people, he's a really, really great jobbing actor. So you will see him in lots of TV shows, so he was in Yellowstone and things like that, and he's actually in Gotham for 100 episodes, wow. But I kind of knew him from the 80s when he was in action movies and stuff like that. I think he was in stuff during the 80s and 90s.
So this is James Remar, right?
Yeah.
He was also in Dexter.
But I never watched Dexter. But that's the thing, is that people would know him from different things. Like, I remember him, yeah, actually, yeah, he was in Blink. He was in the Madeleine Stowe film Blink from the early 90s, and I do like that.
He was not in Aliens.
Yes, of course, because he was Hicks, right? He was recast after shooting for about a week or so, and Michael Biehn came in, and he's just much better. But he's in stuff like 48 Hours as well. I mean, he has like quite a hard-looking face sometimes. He's in The Warrior, of course, his Ajax from The Warriors. So it was great seeing him, because sometimes Chris Nolan will do that. He will put Tom Berenger into the film, and Tom Berenger's in Inception, which was his first theatrically released film for I think about a decade or something. I think Training Day was his previous theatrically released film. So he will cast these straight to video actors in his movie, and it's always great to see them just in a scene or two, just being a very, very good actor.
So with Gary Oldman, I found it a bit distracting. Just because, A, I wasn't expecting him to be in there, and B, Gary Oldman, who's got a reputation of being such a chameleon, or had such a reputation of being such, it just felt like, okay, you're hearing Gary Oldman in this scene because they want someone with charisma who's a safe pair of hands, but it almost feels like a performance I've seen you give before. And that was just weird because I wasn't expecting him to be there, and then he was in there in a role that seemed weirdly familiar.
I had a different reaction to that. Because of course, you think, okay, right, so you also won an Oscar for playing Churchill in Darkest Hour. A film that, as we said at the time, snatches defeat from the jaws of victory. Now he's playing Truman. What I liked about it was that it was a poisonous turn. And I didn't think it was just in terms of him being a safe pair of hands. I thought, my God, in like what is probably no more than 5 minutes of screen time, he shows the callousness of the American government. Just the way that he has no time for Oppenheimer's guilt or regret, and actually seems a little bit annoyed that Oppenheimer is taking credit for it.
He calls him a crybaby when he's leaving.
Which is great. So it's like, yeah, don't let that crybaby back in here. Which is such a great old-fashioned, horrible insult.
I found it interesting the fact that he says, you know, you created it, I used it. Like, do you think the people in Hiroshima and Nagasaki give a damn about the man who created it? I think that's also, like, another way of how you might deal with that. On the hand, you, like, Oppenheimer is an intellectual, but he's also given, you know, seems to be presented as being a moral human being, or at least a human being with moral awareness.
Yeah.
And the film challenges him on that at other points in terms of the logic, you know, how he justified it to himself. But then the other way that you can look at it is Truman's, like, he's completely shut down, who's just completely closed down that part of himself. And the fact that you kind of put that in contrast to Oppenheimer, Truman is aware that he bears responsibility for that. And to the extent that he's able to say, like, I'm the actual guy who dropped it. He has that kind of level of self-awareness, but it just doesn't impact him, or he doesn't allow it to impact him in a way that it does Oppenheimer.
I think he sees it as a weakness in Oppenheimer.
Yeah.
And that's, I think, what is brilliant about that scene, and also what I think is brilliant about the way that Gary Oldman performs it, is it's complete poison. There's no humanity there. He looks utterly contemptuous when Oppenheimer says, I think I've got blood on my hands.
When he proffers that handkerchief.
But he waves it, doesn't he? White flag that's being waved. It's like a surrender thing. And also there seems to be an element of pride there as well, in terms of no one gives a shit about who built the bomb. They only care about who dropped it. I dropped it.
Moi.
No one cares about you. They care about me. I was the one that won the war because I dropped the bomb. His performance is lacking in any compassion. And I thought that was brilliant. And the way that he turns, the way that when he realises what Oppenheimer's trying to say, his face just turns into...
All the bonhomie goes away.
Yeah, and it turns into an utter mask of contempt. That, I think, is why you get Gary Oldman in, because he's such a great actor.
I think maybe also part of the moment was, for me, is that it was one of the... I know that you said the kind of sex scene vision didn't feel... I think that's a moment that didn't feel entirely authentic to me. I think just because Oppenheimer had been so guarded, I didn't necessarily buy that he'd say that to the president.
See, I thought that worked.
I mean, like, I think it felt, like, thematically expedient.
But I thought it worked in terms of the people as well, that it was like... You go to the person, the president, particularly at that time, was such a well-respected office that it's almost like you go to someone who is, he's higher than your rabbi or your priest. He's the father of the nation. You can confide in him. And then you find him to be someone who is vainglorious and hates you for what you are trying to say. And again, it's metaphorical in terms of it would represent the establishment as well.
I think I would have bought it more if it seemed like even maybe more of like an intellectual... Like, I like what you're saying in terms of the president being, the ultimate confessor, the ultimate person that you confess to. But I think, if they positioned it as this is Oppenheimer saying it to the only other person who is, ultimately culpable. He built it, this guy dropped it. If they'd maybe framed it or given Oppenheimer that bit more awareness of that.
I think that's what he was trying to say in terms of saying, I think I've got blood on my hands. But he's completely misjudging the person that he spoke to. Whereas then, at the end, you have the Einstein scene, which is when he can basically say it to someone who understands. Because it's someone who realised how dangerous this was and how it shouldn't have existed. And
that's such a great moment with the old Nehrenreich's final line. Maybe they were talking about something important.
Yeah.
Which is such a wonderful dismissal of the Strauss character, who's like, you're nothing. She's almost like him saying to Oppenheimer was, a great man talking to a great man. Why do you think you would be the subject of conversation? In fact, he's so convinced that...
That because Einstein blanked him, that Oppenheimer said something to poison Einstein against him. And that moment was towards when he realises maybe I never even considered that they might not have been talking about me.
And then he has to step out through the door and smile.
Yeah, which is great, but he does that as a proper politician thing.
And I like how underplayed the moment is where he discovers that, because initially it's like it's going to go through, and then it's going to go like, oh, you might squeak through, so it's okay to get the press. And then it's like, no, the press are here, and you're not going to get it. And the fact that he's just like, the level on which he's just like, okay, that he just kind of has to accept it. And
that little revelation that Kennedy was the person who was leading the charge against
him. A man
him.
Who went on to have, to, whose life was in no way went on to be influenced by the existence of the atomic bomb.
Yeah. And the reason why I think that it was right that the film didn't show Hiroshima or Nagasaki, other than it being a risk of going into spectacle, is that the point is that as soon as he's delivered it, he's forgotten. They don't even tell him that it's been dropped until after it's been dropped.
He finds out about it over radio.
Yeah, that's right.
And then he gets the phone call.
Yeah, that's right,
you are an afterthought. You were a means to an end.
So to show it, it's like, well, no, because you stay with that character, and that character thinks, well, they have to tell me because I did it. So I don't know. You, yeah, as you said, you were a means to an end. The machine and the establishment has now moved on, and it doesn't need you anymore.
And all he can do is imagine it and obviously see the photos. I probably saw some of the same photos that he was presented with when I went to the museum in Hiroshima. And that's, you know, understandably a difficult, you know, it was a busy museum, but we moved around it at a fair pace because you just didn't, you almost couldn't dwell. It was like, you know, you just so much human misery on display.
Yeah, it's, and again, it was right not to put it in the film. You just see the reaction on his face.
And when the film says, you know, people wearing striped clothing had the stripes burned into them.
Yeah, indeed. But also the fact that, I mean, yeah, it's not mentioned in the film, but the people disappeared, but their shadows were left behind, which is this terribly, grimly poetic thing.
That, and this obviously gave the title to another dramatisation about the creation of the nuclear bomb, Shadowmakers. Shadowmaker, was that the...
Yeah, that's what it was ultimately called. Because, of course, the original title for that film, which is 1989, I think, and it's Paul Newman as a Leslie Groves character and Dwight Schultz, Murdoch from the A-Team, plays Oppenheimer very well, was Fat Man and Little Boy, which was the name of the two atom bombs. But people went to Fat Man and Little Boy
expecting
it was a comedy and said, what the fuck is this film?
What the fuck is this?
They tried to split the atom, but the atom split them. Yeah. Then it was renamed Shadowmakers for release outside of America when they realised, yeah, we can't call it Fat Man and Little Boy because no one knows what Fat Man and Little Boy means. Well, I'm glad that you liked it because I walked out of that thinking, oh, I just love that. I love that. It was so brilliant. And it suggests, I mean, it is, I think, an advance for Christopher Nolan in terms of he can bring his style to something that is purely drama, a period drama as well.
Turns out he never liked doing action scenes. He was always like, I'm sorry, Chris, we need this as a vehicle for the ideas that you're interested in.
No! I just want to have people in rooms talking. It has to be said with my trademark natty threads as well, because everyone in this film is impeccably tailored. There's some great waistcoat wearing in this film. But anyway, and a cool, very, very cool hat. And some good pipe work as well. Yeah, it was great. So, be interesting to see where it pops up on the old film of the years list, because I think it's going to. The trailers beforehand, actually, there was some really... I mean, there's a lot of films coming out. So we had Killers of the Flower Moon, we had Napoleon, we had A Haunting in Venice. There's a lot of quite big films coming out. We know the Killers of the Flower Moon's probably going to be around 4 hours, okay? Well, The Irishman was 3.5 hours, and that was my second favourite film.
I can't remember what they were, but there were some trailers for some Japanese re-releases.
Tokyo Story.
Tokyo Story, there we go. That was it.
Yeah.
And I was like...
Wasn't even there, folks.
And there was like just a degree of tragic irony in that. Before you watch this film about the bombs that were dropped in Japan, here's a celebration of Japanese culture.
Tokyo Story is one of the great movies, and if you haven't seen it and you're able to get into London, or even if you've got BFI Play because it's on that as well, then watch Tokyo Story. It is a masterpiece. So brilliant. Anyway, that would be interesting to watch an IMAX because, again, it's a drama. People, it's a family drama.
Yeah.
It is interesting watching a film that isn't a big spectacle in IMAX because it's such a huge format. But anyway.
The Honest Thief.
Oh, yes, I did, yes. Friend of the podcast, Adrian, Zach and myself went to see Honest Thief in IMAX when it was literally the only thing they could play during COVID, during one of the lockdown lifts. It's weird watching a film that small on that massive screen. It did not survive, really. It was interesting. Yeah, Napoleon's not going to be short, is it? It might not be the 5.5 hours that...
Sorry, did you say that with due irony?
Oh, yeah, indeed. Yes, indeed. Very good. See, sometimes they just write themselves, Rob.
Apparently he wasn't even short.
Yeah. Was he about 5'7" or something?
Yeah, he was like average height for the time.
Yeah.
But that's not funny.
Print the legend. Anyway, and then we couldn't have Ian Holm play him in...
Time Bandits.
Time Bandits, yeah. When the Avril Gantz silent film, which is also one of the best films ever made, is 5.5 hours and is fucking brilliant. You do need to put a day aside to watch it, though, because you need some breaks, because it is 5.5 hours and it is a silent film, but it's brilliant. So yeah, it'd be interesting to see how long this one is. The trailer looked pretty good, though. But anything else to say about Oppenheimer before we wrap up?
Yeah, if this doesn't make the upper reaches, or sorry, the lower reaches, the top five, if this doesn't make my top three of the year, then it will have been an astonishing era film.
Yeah, yeah, indeed, definitely. And it will be very interesting to see what Christopher Nolan does next, because other than Tenet, all of his films have looked very different to the one before, or like, yeah, to his previous ones. Other than, like, yeah, obviously the Dark Knight films are of a type. But Tenet was like, well, this looks quite like Inception and other things that you've done. But he always surprises, I think, other than Tenet, with what he does. So it'll be fascinating to see what he does next. And I'm very happy this has done well, because it kind of means he can choose his next project with free rein. Although he is talking about what a privilege it would be to do a Bond film. And it's like, okay, but...
Hey, you know, if you're gonna look, if they're struggling to figure out how to bring it back, getting Nolan to direct...
Yeah.
Feels like, although it might end up falling into the Sam Mendes trap, but as long as he just says, I'm doing one of them, it's not a fucking template...
I mean, I do think that we've had a Christopher Nolan film, a Christopher Nolan Bond film in Skyfall, because, I mean, even Sam Mendes acknowledged the influence of Christopher Nolan on that film. I mean, that's a very, very Nolan Bond film, but...
Luckily, he went on to do something completely distinct afterwards.
Yes, indeed, which was 1917, which was another war film that dealt with time in an interesting way, because it did seem as if he was Nolan's shadow for a while, so it'd be interesting to see if his next film is about, I don't know, Louis Pasteur or something... or Madame Curie. I'm more interested in what Chris Nolan does next than in what Sam Mendes does next, but although I haven't seen his one about cinema yet, so that might be quite nice. You saw it, didn't you?
It's all right, it's on Disney Plus.
What is it again?
Empire of Light.
Right, okay. Well, on that note, cheers for listening, and we will come at you again very, very soon with, well, it might be The Meg 2.
Do you mean The Meg, The Trench? Is that what it's called?
Oh, is it? Okay,
is it called The Trench?
I thought it was called Meg 2.
It might just be called Meg 2, although it has a brilliant tagline. New Meg, old chum.
Oh, it is directed by Ben Wheatley.
That Which is just fucking weird.
That immediately piques my interest, to be honest. It's like...
From the director of Sightseers in a field in England.
A Kill List.
And in all fairness, Free Fire is probably the closest he's come, although that's...
But it does star Cillian Murphy, but it's not a mainstream movie. Anyway, yeah, we'll see what Ben... And episodes of Doctor Who. But we will see what he does with that.
Yep, first few Capaldi episodes.
That's right. Well, we should probably wrap it up here. So thank you very much. And thank you very much, Rob.
Thank you very much. And thank you very much for listening.
And we'll talk to you again very, very soon.
You are the man who gave them the power to destroy themselves. And the world is not prepared.